From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the return of soul singer Howard Tate. In the late 60s, he had the R&B hits Stop, Ain't Nobody Home, and Get It While You Can, which was later covered by Janis Joplin. After disappearing from the music scene for nearly 30 years, leaving fans to speculate that he was dead, Tate has a new comeback album called Rediscover, and he has an explanation of where he was all that time. The story includes drug addiction, living on the streets, and getting born again. We'll talk with Tate and producer-songwriter Jerry Ragavoy, who worked with Tate in the 60s and has teamed up with him again. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel American Woman by Susan Choi. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Firefighters in Southern California say weather conditions are helping the battle against wildfires that have killed at least 13 people and destroyed about 1,100 homes. Alex Cohen of member station KQED reports from Los Angeles.
For days, fierce winds have blown fires throughout Southern California, but today, gusty offshore winds began to settle down in Ventura and Los Angeles counties. Los Angeles Fire Chief Bill Bamatri says crews will take advantage of the change in weather.
We've been in a defensive mode, trying to protect structure fires as the weather conditions and the brush terrain have been difficult for us to mount an offensive attack. What we hope to take advantage of today is a little bit of break in the wind.
In response to the wildfires in four Southern California counties, President Bush has declared a major disaster exists, which will clear the way for federal help for local governments and individuals affected by the fire. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen in Los Angeles.
California Governor Gray Davis visited several of the fire-stricken areas today and said government help will be essential.
To their credit, everyone in the neighborhood was in good spirits. But I know when reality sets in that they'll want to get on with putting their lives back in order. And that will take financial relief and assistance from the federal government.
Suicide car bombers struck three police stations and the Red Cross headquarters in Baghdad today, killing at least 35 people, including one American soldier. New York Times photographer Joao Silver describes the scene at the Red Cross compound.
We arrived at the scene. We were confronted with various burning vehicles, a lot of confusion, panicked police running around trying to keep people back. We counted at least six corpses at first sight before we eventually were told to leave the scene.
President Bush insisted today that money Congress appropriates for Iraq's reconstruction must be in the form of grants and not loans. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Congress has not yet finished work on an aid package for Iraq, but both the House and Senate have included provisions making a portion of the money a loan. The president has requested $87 billion, which includes some money for Afghanistan as well. He spoke at an Oval Office meeting with Paul Bremer, the top U.S. official in Iraq.
My attitude has been and still is that the money we provide Iraq ought to be a form in the grant. And the reason why is we want to make sure that the constraints on the Iraqi people are limited so that they can flourish and become a free and prosperous society.
White House aides have said they'll recommend the president's first veto if the bill does include the loan provision, but the president has not yet issued such a threat himself. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 25 points to close at 9,608 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 17 points to close at 1,883. This is NPR News. Bank of America has agreed to buy Fleet Boston Financial Corporation for $47 billion in stock. The combined bank would be the second largest in the country with more than $930 billion in assets. But it also means the end of an institution in New England, NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Boston politicians, bank employees, and community groups are wondering what the sale of the region's largest bank will mean. In addition to being a major employer, Fleet has been one of the top corporate philanthropic donors. Fleet CEO and chairman Chad Gifford tried to allay fears, saying he'd gotten agreements from Bank of America.
To hold our philanthropy as it is now, and to have New England jobs basically stay flat and then grow again with the overall level of domestic employment.
One thing will be changing. The Fleet Center, home to the Celtics basketball team and a major performance venue, will be renamed. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
The FBI reports that the number of serious crimes in the United States edged up a bit last year. Jack Levin of Northeastern University's Brudnick Center on Violence says crime was down in American cities and up in suburban areas.
There's migration from the cities into the suburbs, causing the crime rate to rise. And at the same time, I don't think the residents of the suburbs were prepared.
Levin says the overall crime rate remains well below the levels seen in the 1990s. The Internal Revenue Service is looking for more than 200,000 people who have refunds and credits coming. The IRS says it's been unable to distribute more than $118 million that have gone undelivered because of bad addresses. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, working to end poverty, build self-sufficiency, and spread human dignity throughout the world. AJWS.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Howard Tate, is a soul singer who's making a comeback after disappearing for nearly 30 years. Many fans, DJs, and music journalists figured he was dead. They were almost right. He'd been living on the streets doing whatever he needed to do to get money to feed his drug habit. He put some of the blame for his downward spiral on a fire that destroyed his home and killed one of his children. Now Tate is born again and has been a minister since 1994, and he's recording again. In fact, he's teamed up with the songwriter and producer he first worked with, Jerry Ragavoy. Ragavoy wrote the song Get It While You Can, which Tate recorded in 1967 and was later covered by Janis Joplin. Joplin also recorded Ragavoy's songs Try, Cry Baby, and Piece of My Heart. The Rolling Stones recorded Ragavoy's Time Is On My Side. Before we meet Howard Tate and Jerry Ragavoy, let's listen to a song written by Ragavoy from Tate's new CD, Rediscovered.
Sorry, wrong number. Ain't nobody here by that name. No use reminiscing, 'cause this time I just won't listen. Don't need the pain, oh no. I'm sorry, wrong number. Baby, you're just wasting your time. I made myself forget you. About to let you back in my mind. Oh no. There was a time I lived only for you. You said our love, all our love couldn't die.
That's Reverend Howard Tate from his new CD, which is called Rediscovered. And the album was produced by Jerry Ragavoy, who's also featured on keyboards. Howard Tate, Jerry Ragavoy, welcome both of you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nice to be here, Terry.
Howard Tate, this album marks your return to music, a return to music after kicking drugs and alcohol and after being homeless for a while. Is there anything you feel like you're trying to do different this time around?
Yes, this time around, I have a goal in mind. I'm trying to build a rehab center and buy houses to house the homeless. Having been there, I know what it's about, and I feel as though who better to participate and do that than I.
Jerry Ragavoy, I understand that when Howard Tate was kind of missing in action, nobody really knew where he was. that you had been trying to find him, is that right?
Well, yes and no. Howard sort of disappeared around 1972. And I just accepted that as a fact of life and didn't do anything about it. In the early 80s, I started getting phone calls from various club owners across the country. In fact, some even in Europe were calling, looking for Howard Tate to book him in clubs. And I said, well, I'll try to find him for you. And that went on for, I would say, close to 10 years. And after a while, since I couldn't find Howard anywhere, I presumed that maybe he passed away, which is certainly not unlikely, you know, given Howard's age and so forth. And one day I got a call from a journalist in London, England, who told me that he's doing an article about Howard Tate in one of the magazines there. And would I mind answering some questions of, such as, what was it like to work with Howard in the studio? And I happened to comment, I said, really? I said, you know, I've been looking for Howard for about 10 years. And the journalist replied, oh, really? I spoke to him yesterday. And it was like, what? Anyway, I got Howard's number and I called him. And soon we were talking about the possibility of recording again. So I brought him down to Atlanta just to hear what he sounds like. Before I pursued any recording, I wanted to be sure that the voice was still there. And I tried Howard out on a song. Don't remember which one it was. But in any event, I heard his voice, and I was in total shock. I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Howard Tate, how does it make you feel to hear Jerry Ragavoy say that he'd basically given you up for dead, that you had disappeared, no one could find you, and so he started to assume the worst?
Well, it was surprising to me that not only he, but many writers had given me up for dead, and they just didn't know where to look, of course, you know.
Did you have a sense that people were looking for you or that people cared?
Terry, I had no idea. I didn't even think anybody cared. I never thought they even cared anything about my music or anything. I was totally shocked.
So when you started to hook up again with Jerry Ragavoy, what did you think about the idea of recording together again?
Well, I knew when I met Jerry back in the 60s, there was something about his arranging, and I knew I was an exceptional singer, and I knew that I thought that he could, with the combination, I thought we could set the world on fire. And our very first record was a hit, Ain't Nobody Home. And the second one was a hit, and Stop was a hit. You know, but it was hard to cross over back there, of course. But R&B, we were tearing the charts up.
Let's hear another track that you recently recorded together. And this is a duet. Jerry Ragavoy, you're at the piano. Howard Tate, you're singing. And it's a song that you did together many years ago that Jerry Ragavoy, you wrote. And a lot of people will also know this song from Janis Joplin's version of it. And the song is Get It While You Can. Before we hear it, Jerry Ragavoy, what inspired the writing of this song?
I wrote that in the very middle 60s with Mort Shuman. And we simply just wrote it because we thought it was a message that was very powerful and almost universal and almost surely have longevity. And that was one of the reasons we wrote it.
And how did Howard Tate end up singing it?
Well, we thought it came out so terrific in our own opinion. I decided to do it with Howard and did an arrangement, and we recorded it. And several months later, Janis Joplin recorded it.
Had she heard his version? Is that what happened?
Oh, absolutely. That was the reason she recorded it.
And Howard Tate, how did you feel when Janis Joplin not only recorded it, but had this huge hit of it? Like, it was a song that was more associated with her than with you, because most people had heard her version. More people had heard her version than yours.
Well, I never heard Janis sing the song until I came back. Of course, when I left the music industry, I just completely cut myself off from it.
Oh.
And I didn't listen to radio or anything like that. So when I heard the story and how her record was such a hit and I heard her sing it when I come back, I was amazed.
When was this? Was this like recently?
Well, it was 2 years ago. close to 3 years ago.
That's amazing to me that you'd be so disconnected that you wouldn't even know she did.
I didn't even know she did it.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't know B.B. King did Ain't Nobody Home. I didn't know Jimi Hendrix did Stop. You know, Roy Crotter. I didn't know he did Look at Granny Run, but they were covering these songs all over the place.
Ray Cooter.
Yeah, Ray Cooter, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I just walked away from it, and I didn't listen to the radio. I didn't want to hear anything about it, and I just isolated myself from it completely.
Okay, well, let's hear the new version of Get It While You Can, the duet version that Howard Tate recorded with Jerry Ragovoy on piano. And again, Jerry Ragovoy wrote the song. This is on the new Howard Tate album, Rediscovered, and it's really good. Let's hear it.
Thank you.
I want to tell you a little bit about myself. Once I had a good woman, but I didn't count my blessings. Oh, I wish she could hear me. You see, oh, I've learned a bitter lesson. So if someone comes along and gives you genuine affection, get it while you can. You better go on and get it while you can. Better get it while you can. Don't turn your back on love. I want to say it one more time. Get it while you can.
That's Get It While You Can, written by my guest Jerry Ragovoy, sung by my other guest, Reverend Howard Tate, on Howard Tate's new album, Rediscovered. And it teams up Ragovoy and Tate, who first worked together in the early 60s. And Howard Tate disappeared from the music industry for many years and was recently rediscovered. Howard Tate, let's talk about how you ended up disappearing for so long from the music industry. First of all, when did you and Jerry Ragovoy stop working together? You're such a great match, as we just heard.
Well, after we did the Atlantic LP, Howard Tate, after that record, we separated. I walked away from the music industry altogether, and because I had might have been a little high strung and might have misinterpreted some things at that time, as we all do, and it was financial issues, and I might have misunderstood some facts back there, and I'm sure I did, and so I walked away from it, very bitter, you know, right or wrong, I was very bitter, and you know, and that's what happened.
Jerry Ragovoy, what's your version of that story?
Well, there's very little to contradict. He simply disappeared, and I never knew what happened to him.
Didn't say goodbye, didn't say our collaboration's ended?
No, no flowers.
And were you aware of what Reverend Tate was just describing, that he was feeling very bitter about his financial standing within the music industry?
He sort of disappeared virtually overnight, and I never had the opportunity to discuss why, how, or when. It just happened, period. He was gone.
So where'd you go when you were gone?
Well, I went back and I sold insurance for a while, but I was so depressed until I fell into the drug scene, and I couldn't get it out of my mind that I hit so fast when we came out of the stall. We came out and they released Ain't Nobody Home, and I was working. I came home from work one day, and a big limousine was sitting in front of the door, and they said, you got to get in here right away. They gave me $1,000. They said, you got to get a suit. You're playing with Marvin Gaye tomorrow night. That's how fast I hit. And and right behind that, Look at Granny Run and Stop. And so that kept flashing back in my mind, because there must be so many thousands of artists that cut records, millions, and they can't hit. And I came out to shoot and hit, you know, big time. And So that flashed back through my mind, and that I thought drugs would alleviate that depressed feeling that I had, which was a crucial mistake. It only led to destruction, homelessness, and all of that, and that's what happened.
What was your drug of choice?
Cocaine.
An expensive choice.
Expensive choice, and it'll completely destroy you, and it destroyed me. It's a miracle that I'm sitting here and I'm back. So that title of this newest CD, Rediscovered, is the proper title.
Okay, so first of all, I'm having a hard time picturing you selling insurance. Okay, so you're selling insurance for a while. And then there was also something else that happened in your life. Your house burned down, and I think that was a turning point for you also.
Yes, that was something else to depress me. I lost a daughter, 13 years old, in a house fire. And behind that, behind the music industry and the house fire, my marriage was, I went through a divorce. And so it was just a devastating period for me. And of course, I thought the more drugs I did that, that would be the answer. But it wasn't the answer.
Well, part of your bitterness with the music industry was that you didn't feel you were making the money that you should have been making. So how could you afford an expensive cocaine habit? What did you do to get the money that you needed for that?
Well, it's a funny thing that junkies find ways to get money. They'll get a hustle going. And, of course, I did yard work. I would do odds and ends. I would walk for miles and whatever. I never robbed anybody, or I never was a stick-up artist or anything like that. Thank God for that. But I would walk miles to make $20 and run right back to the dope man. And then I'd walk another 20 miles if I had to till I got that next $20. I'd do that from morning to night for almost 10 years of my life to support that habit.
My guests are Howard Tate and Jerry Ragavoy. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are soul singer Howard Tate and producer-songwriter Jerry Ragavoy. Tate's new comeback CD is called Rediscovered. Howard Tate, this is an odd question, so forgive me for asking it. And if it's too personal, don't answer it. You're missing a tooth.
Yes.
Is there a story behind that missing tooth?
Yes. I've never told this before, but I was picking up drugs one night in Camden, New Jersey, and a young guy tried to take the drugs. It was three or four of them, and he hit me with a brick. Knocked me out, took the drugs, and when I come to, there was a Spanish fella standing over me. He says, I wasn't going to leave you, mister. I wasn't going to leave you. I was going to stay here till you came around, and that's what happened, yes. It just goes to show you how dangerous the drug scene can be, and that people shouldn't get mixed up in drugs. They should definitely stay away from drugs.
Did you ever say to yourself, did you ever look around at the other people who were doing what you were doing to feed their habit, and look at the drug dealers who you were buying from, and look at the other homeless people who you knew, and say to yourself, what am I doing here? I'm Howard Tate. I'm a recording artist. I'm a terrific soul singer. What am I doing here?
Well, there was times when I would, within myself, remember who I was and where I'd come from and the success I had had. But cocaine, those drugs destroy your very will. They destroy everything about you, your pride, everything. And I lived for the drug. There wasn't many times I realized I had fallen into that subculture with that subculture, and I was trapped there. At least that's what I thought, because I never thought I'd make it out alive.
Did you sing at all during that period? Never, and I don't mean performing. I mean just singing to yourself.
Never sang a note. I never sang a note all those years. In fact, when I met Jerry in New York, and he says, I'm going to send you a couple of demos, and you learn these songs, and I'm going to have you come to Atlanta to see how you sound on them. He sent me the demos, and the truth about the matter, Terry, I never once opened my mouth to sing those demos, not once. I could not bring myself to listen to the singer that he had on the demos for me to learn the songs by, and I could not bring myself to sing those songs. I only did it when I got down to his studio and stepped up to the mic and opened my mouth, and it was all there.
Well, you were afraid of what would come out?
I really was, yes. I wasn't sure I could sing anymore. I just didn't know.
Did you feel like you hadn't done your homework when you showed up at Jerry Ragavoy's studio and you hadn't even heard the songs you were supposed to record?
I knew the words, and I knew the melody, but I knew that I had not done my homework. That was your question. I know I had not done my homework because I hadn't tried to sing them.
Oh, I thought you hadn't even listened to them.
Oh, I listened to them hundreds of times.
I knew
the words, but I was afraid to open my mouth and try to sing the songs because I thought the voice was gone.
Well, what went through your mind after so many years singing those notes for the first time?
I was completely, when I opened my mouth and I stepped up to the mic, I knew it was a miracle. And Jerry didn't know it, of course, but I was thanking God with all my heart and soul that he had blessed me to still have the voice.
So Jerry Ragavoy, I want to hear more about your first impressions when Howard Tate sang, and if you had any clue that he hadn't sung until that moment.
I didn't know that part of the story where he hadn't sung at all. However, when he was there and when I did hear him sing, I was truly amazed by what I was hearing. The Howard I knew from 35 years ago compared to what I heard at that time was virtually identical. The only difference that I saw, or heard rather, might be that his voice was a trifle darker. Beyond that, the same voice. And I thought the darkness, I should add, added a little more character.
And then, Jerry Ragavoy, did you try to convince Howard Tate that he should return to recording and performing?
It did not take much convincing. We both knew it, and it was both of us knew we were going to go forward.
Howard Tate's new CD, produced by Jerry Ragavoy, is called Rediscovered. They'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. From Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. And by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young at bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with singer Howard Tate and producer and songwriter Jerry Ragavoy, and Maureen Carrigan reviews the new novel, American Woman.
That's what's gonna happen, baby. Never knew how good a love could be. Love is gonna make a fool of me. Everything is hazy. One more kiss and you'll drive me crazy. Baby, stop. Hold it up a minute, cause I've gotta catch my breath. You know what you do to me, baby.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are soul singer Howard Tate and producer-songwriter Jerry Ragavoy. They've collaborated on Tate's comeback CD, Rediscovered. They first worked together in the late 60s. Ragavoy wrote Tate's R&B hit Get It While You Can, which was later recorded by Janis Joplin. Tate disappeared for years while he was addicted to drugs and living on the street. When we left off, Ragavoy and Tate were talking about meeting again in 2001 after Tate cleaned up and deciding to record again. Howard Tate, this meant changing your life a lot. Now, we neglected to mention that after this period of homelessness and drug addiction, you had a spiritual experience.
Yes.
And lived in a shelter for a while.
Yes.
Joined a church, started your own ministry, became Reverend Howard Tate.
Yes.
So starting music again meant giving up some of that new life that you'd created, right?
Yes, it meant giving up some. It didn't have to mean giving up some of it, but we had a split in the church, you know.
About whether this was a good thing or not?
Whether it was a good thing, yes.
Well, it must have been odd having other people kind of voting on what your future should be.
Right.
So what was the pro and the con side about?
Well, the pro side was that, you know, this could be a good thing because I could go all over the world and reach so many people with the life I live and, you know, and have so many people, you know, that I can see and talk to and reach. And the con side was, well, you can't have it both ways, you know. Either you're going to do the work of the Lord, or either you're going to serve the devil, and that was the con part of it, you know. And I'm one to believe, and I prayed a lot about this, that you can't put God in a bottle or a box, you know. And the Lord answered me and said that I gave you that voice, you know. And when I set you free from being a junkie all those years and brought you back and kept you alive, you know, when you were drugging out there, you could have got your throat slit. Yeah, you could have got a couple of bullets in the back of your head, walking the streets all night as you did. I took care of you. So if I choose for you to use that voice, secular, you know, and spiritual, because you can certainly sing some spiritual records too, you know, who's to question me?
Had you been singing in church at all?
No, I had not.
And what about the other people in the church? Did they have a clue about your past, or was this news to them?
They didn't know. It was totally new to them. They didn't have an inkling that I had ever made a record in my life.
Now, why didn't you tell them?
It was something I walked away from, and I swore by God that I would never, ever go back to it, and that I never wanted to even anybody to know I was associated with the music industry.
Why?
I was so bitter. I hit so fast coming out of this chute, like I said, and it was fast. And we won't number one in all the major cities on the radio, R&B radio station. Back then, that day, AM stations were the stations, and R&B. But crossing over was awfully hard to do, and I was riding on top of the charts in all the cities. And as far as I was concerned, I was selling tons and tons of records, and I couldn't see no money. So I thought, you know, and I just got bitter over it. I was totally bitter.
Didn't you want to say to the people in the church, you see me now as like an addicted homeless person, but I have a gift, I have a voice, and I was somebody in the performance world too?
I didn't want to do that. I was ashamed of the music business. And I was ashamed to say that I had those hit records and had to walk away penniless. So I think there was a certain amount of shame that I could get caught up in that and be so ignorant that I didn't get, you know, lawyers and things like that to protect me back there. And so.
Now, you said that the church basically voted on whether
yes.
whether you should be singing secular music or not. So who
yes.
who won the vote?
Well, they gave me an ultimatum that either I would not come back and record and sing secular music again, or I would be cut off from my salary, and they cut me off from my salary, and I had to move out of the home, the rectory that they had provided, and so I had to do that. And I wanted to build a rehab center and buy houses to house the homeless in the state of New Jersey, and I knew I'd need a lot of money to do this. And I said to him, well, you're not able to give me the kind of money I'm looking for. I think the Lord is leading me with all that has happened. They re-released the Get It While You Can album in Europe, and it took off and sold all over the place, and that's how I was rediscovered. So if God is opening up this avenue for me to get the money to help others to escape the prison I was in, the drugs and the homelessness, then I'm going to take that route. And so I gave up the pastorship and became pastor of Gift of the Cross Outreach Ministry. I'm the pastor of that. And I decided to record the CD.
Okay. Well, you were talking about how your life had changed so suddenly after, like, you made your first recording, yes. And it immediately became an R&B hit, and suddenly you were given money by the record company, you were on tour, and it was like overnight.
Yes.
Why don't we hear that recording?
Okay.
That first recording that hit, and I think this is the one that you're referring to, Ain't Nobody Home.
Right.
Okay. And Jerry Ragavoy, you wrote the song.
Yes.
And produced the record.
Yes.
What year are we talking?
I believe it was 1967.
All right, let's hear it. This is Howard Tate.
How many times I begged for you to come home, but you laughed at me and said, let me alone. And through my burning tears, I saw you walk away.
That's Howard Tate, recorded in 1967, and after many years of having disappeared from the music industry, disappeared so much no one knew where he was because he was homeless and addicted for several years, he has been rediscovered, and he's recording again. His new CD is called Rediscovered, and it's produced by Jerry Ragavoy, who used to produce Howard Tate back in the 60s, and who also wrote the song that we just heard, Ain't Nobody Home. Jerry Ragavoy, did you write the song specifically for Howard Tate, Ain't
Yes.
Nobody Home?
Yes.
And what was it about the song that seemed to you like it would work for Howard Tate's voice?
In our business, we never know. If we knew the answer, what was going to be a hit, we'd have more money than Bill Gates, I suppose. But I felt that Howard could execute what I had in my mind. One of the few singers that sort of inspired me to some form of artistic license, as it were. And Howard had the broadest range, and there was a lot of things that he could do that other singers could not, in terms of my particular concepts.
How did you both start working together? And then we're talking about early 60s here?
Yes.
Well, just briefly, an artist I was working with at the time, Garnett Mims,
mm-hmm.
who also I had was fortunate, had a few hits with him as well, introduced me to Howard Tate, told me about a singer he knew, and he thought I should hear him, which I did.
Howard Tate, you'd been singing with Garnett Mims, right?
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Okay.
Yes. And I forgot about that. But in any event, I listened to Howard on tape, and I found it very interesting, and I wanted to pursue it further. And after hearing Howard personally, just sort of nothing in special, just banging around on the piano and having Howard sing personally, I realized something very important was before my very eyes. And I decided this artist should be recorded.
Howard Tate, when you started working with Jerry Ragavoy producing you, Did you start doing anything different? Did he give you suggestions of doing things that you hadn't thought of before?
Well, I came out of the church, and I always was a falsette singer. You might say a sweet singer, because some of my idols were Sam Cooke.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam, you know, he was a versatile singer, and Ira Tucker and the Dixie Hummingbirds and Clarence and the Blind Boys of Out of Alabama. They're still around, by the way. And Claude Jeter with the Swan Silver Tones used to sing a lot of falsetto. And I would listen to him, and I'd practice that falsetto. And I perfected it as good as he did. I was trying to imitate him note for note. And I think that's how I really came about using the falsetto. But when I got to Jerry Ragavore, you might have could compare me as a basketball player such as Allen Iverson, who came out of college raw with lots of talent, but had to be fine-tuned. And that's where Jerry came in, and he taught me how to fine-tune the falsetto and where to use it at and the finesse of using it and how to capture people with it. And that style I attribute a lot to Jerry Ragavore.
My guests are soul singer Howard Tate and producer-songwriter Jerry Ragavore. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are soul singer Howard Tate and producer-songwriter Jerry Ragavore. They first worked together in the 60s. They've teamed up on Tate's new CD, Rediscovered, his comeback recording after a long period of addiction and homelessness. Now, Howard Tate, you started singing in church. Your father was a minister.
That's right.
In a Baptist church.
Yes.
You grew up in Macon, Georgia. You were born in Macon, Georgia, and then
yes.
As a boy moved to Philadelphia.
That's right.
So what kind of preacher was your father?
He was a Baptist preacher and folk preacher, you know, and I started singing in his church, I guess, at about 7 or 8 years old. And I sang in his church. I'd bring the sermon. He'd bring the sermon, rather, and I'd sing before he'd bring the sermon. And at about 14, 15, another group visited. Garnett Mims was the lead singer of that group. And they were called the Bel Airs. And we sang before the Bel Airs sang, and they heard me singing. And they kind of freaked out over my voice singing that falsetto, and they approached me. They said, Garnett sings all this hard gospel stuff like Ira Tucker with the Dixie Hummingbirds, but we need somebody like a Sam Cooke or a Claude Jeter with the Swan Silver Tones. Would you be interested in joining our group? If you are, come over to the rehearsal Tuesday night. And I went over, and we just fit like hand and glove, and that's how Garnett and I started singing together.
How old were you then about?
I was probably about 15, 16 years old.
What was it like for you when your voice changed?
My voice never changed.
It never changed?
It never changed.
Were you singing in falsetto as a boy?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It never changed.
And it still hasn't changed. I mean, it's still...
It still hasn't changed.
Wow.
Amazing.
So when you made that transition from singing in church to singing on stage, what were some of the changes you had to make?
Well, just to learn the melodies, and that was really the only thing, because the voice was there, and I used the same technique and approach to the songs. So that basically was the only changes I had to make.
And what about in your image, your look?
Well, that had to change a lot. I had to grow a pretty high pompadour back there.
Well, I have a great record right here from your first album, the Get It While You Can record. Your pompadour
right.
Looks like about 4 inches high.
Yes, it was pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, Joe Tex taught me how to dress when I went on the road, because the very first show I did out in Detroit at the 20 Grand, I didn't know how to dress, and I was playing with Marvin Gaye, and he looked like $1 million. No, he looked like $5 million. And I just didn't know how to dress, and Joe Tex pulled me aside. He said, look, man, here's where we get our suits made, and they booked me on the tour with him shortly thereafter, and I went up in New York and had half dozen suits made. And he showed me where to buy the shoes at and all that kind of stuff, and we'd buy those $300 patent leather shoes, and so that's how that came about. And so my image was changed as far as the attire went and as far as the hair went. Yeah.
What color were the suits and the shoes?
Well, we wore loud suits, green, red, blood red, violet, yellow, white. We always wore loud suits out there on the road, you know.
What effect did that, did those colors, did that loud clothing have on the audience?
It had a tremendous effect, because when we'd walk out, I mean, the whole house would just come down. I mean, you know, the women would go to running and screaming and trying to get, they'd have to have a line of policemen up the front, you know, they'd have to have 100 police officers up there holding hands to keep them away from you, because they was literally trying to get at you to rip those clothes off you to get a piece of souvenir.
Now, here's the kind of thing I can't help but wonder. When you were homeless.
Yes.
And you were living on the street and addicted to cocaine, did you let yourself think about those moments when you were in your bright green suit on stage and the women are going crazy?
No. I never let my mind go back to reflect upon that. It was something that I just completely erased from my mind. And I never thought about it until I was miraculously rediscovered. And when Jerry Ragavoy called me that day, then my mind began to go back to those years. And I sit down on the sofa in the living room and I started thinking, you know, something's happening in here. Do I want to go back? I really had to think about it then. But prior to that, no, I never thought about those days or anything like that.
You had talked a little bit about your period of being homeless and being addicted, and then I know there was some kind of spiritual awakening or being born again. What exactly happened? What exactly was the religious side of this transformation?
Well, Terry, the truth is I never thought I would escape the subculture of drugs. That is a prison that any hard drugs such as cocaine, heroin, or anything like that, once you get hooked on that, usually the only way out is death. I seriously thought I would end up dead. But it took me down so low. I was homeless for all those years. And I just called on the name of the Lord one day. It had done me so bad, and I was at such a low. And I just said, Lord, help me. And when I said that, I was being attacked. I wanted it. The urge was hitting me. And I couldn't get away from it. But when I said that, it left me. And that's what made me realize, to make a long story short, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time here, but only when I would say that, Lord, help me, would that urge leave me. I would come under attack. I would really be under attack. I would want that drug so bad that I would walk 30 miles to get $20. I would beg people, let me clean your garage. Let me wash your car. Let me cut your lawn. Let me clean your gutters just to get $20. Only when I called on the name of the Lord did that urge leave me. And I started realizing something's happening in here. And if I want to ever escape this, I'd better seriously call on the Lord and ask him to completely set me free. And that's what happened. He set me free.
So what happened after that? How did you meet the people from the church?
Well, when he set me free, I was so happy. I didn't have a Bible. I went up to the Catholic church. I was walking, and I passed the Catholic church, and I went in. I asked the priest, could you give me a Bible? He gave me a Bible. I still have that Bible today. And I started going around to find churches, because I would read the Bible all day long, all night long. And I would visit different churches, because I knew that that was the only thing that had helped me. And I shared my story with some of the churches, and some of them would come and get me, and take me to Bible studies and different things like that. And that's how I started fellowshipping with other churches, because I found when I was around the Christians, when I read the Bible and when I prayed, I could stay free of the drug. When I didn't do that, I relapsed. And I had a couple of relapses, but I got right back to doing that. And when I continued to do that, it didn't happen again.
Do you worry about relapses now?
Yes, I worry every day, because I know I'm no farther from that crack pipe and the coke table than the minute I stop calling on the name of the Lord. So I call on him all the time. And I say to him, it's me again. I know I'm worrying you, but I don't have anybody else to worry. And he keeps me.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
And congratulations on the new CD.
Thank you.
Singer Howard Tate and producer-songwriter Jerry Ragavoy collaborated on Tate's comeback CD, Rediscovered.
Get it while you can. I want to tell you tonight, you better get it while you can. Ooh, get it while you can. Don't turn your back on love. Don't turn your back on love.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, American Woman. This is Fresh Air. Susan Choi's first novel, The Foreign Student, won the Asian American Literary Award for Fiction. She's just published her second novel, called American Woman, which is loosely based on the Patty Hearst kidnapping case in the 70s. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
So far, this year in books has exhibited a wildly irregular rhythm. Late winter, spring, and summer were sort of sluggish. Then fall arrived, and suddenly one wonderful book after another has been speeding off the assembly line. I feel like Lucy and Ethel in the Chocolate Factory, trying to stuff these bonbons of fiction, biography, and narrative history down my gullet as fast as I can, while still remembering to chew. I've just finished Susan Choi's remarkable novel, American Woman, published last month. It's a story that makes a reader slow down and pay attention, no matter how frenetic the pace of one's routine. American Woman is set in the mid-1970s, and it's inspired, but not constricted by, the Patty Hearst kidnapping case. Choi must have been a toddler when that odd episode occurred, but the real evidence of her imaginative gifts is the fact that this novel focuses not on the Patty Hearst figure, here called Pauline, but on a minor player, a Japanese-American woman named Jenny Shimada, who's by temperament and training an unlikely radical. Jenny has been living underground for a couple of years when Pauline's kidnapping takes place. She's on the lam for setting off a bomb in a San Francisco office building as a protest against the war in Vietnam. In part one of this novel, a fellow radical seeks Jenny's whereabouts and discovers her burrowed into an old dowager's mansion in Rhinecliffe, New York. With her small hands that were so dexterous at making bombs, Jenny has been earning a living of sorts, restoring the mansion's elaborate paintwork. Choi's description of Jenny's submerged life in upstate New York is lulling in its precision. We learn about Jenny's careful avoidance of daily routine in the town and about how she listens to the Watergate hearings on a transistor radio as she furiously scrapes old paint off a ceiling. It's almost painful to watch her yanked out of this soft, solitary imprisonment and pulled back into active revolutionary duty. But her hard-won knowledge of how to survive underground is needed by three fugitives, one of them Pauline, who've just escaped a blazing police shootout in California. Jenny and the fugitives retreat to an isolated farmhouse, and in the following sections of the novel, the narrative perspective widens out to include flashbacks to Japanese-American internment camps during World War II, as well as to the emergence of the Second Women's Movement and anticipations of identity politics coming out of the crumbling of the New Left. We also enter the minds of all the characters in hiding, including Pauline, whose kidnapping and subsequent well-publicized embracing of radical violence mystifies the outside world. Here's a fragment of a passage in which the narrator describes Pauline's conversion process and her feelings towards her new comrades in arms. She'd possibly fallen a little in love. Not because they were the comrades she'd sought before knowing quite what she was seeking. Not because they had words for the frightening world, lists of reasons and crucial solutions. Just because she was 19 years old and might have fallen in love with any collection of beings devoted to lofty ideals. Generally speaking, American writers tend to stay away from explicitly political subjects in their literary fiction, maybe because of the daunting challenge of how to make a political novel smart as well as lyrical and moving. Of course, there are exceptions. E.L. Doctorow, Todd Gitlin, and Philip Roth have mined this New Left territory in their fiction. So did Marge Piercy before she surrendered herself to poetry. Susan Choi is a fresh voice among these sonorous scribes of the 60s, but she more than holds her own. When Jenny's flight from the feds inevitably ends in capture, Choi makes readers feel a grief that ripples out from the personal to the political to the universal and timeless. It's not that you're mourning the end of Jenny's misguided violence, but rather the idealism that prompted it. Here's how Choi's narrator puts it better. The loss of Jenny's freedom, of these years of her 20s, ended up being nothing next to the loss of her confidence in the choices she'd made.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed American Woman by Susan Choi. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, Film Starts Here, commercial-free features, world cinema, documentaries, and shorts, listings at sundancechannel.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Horowitz, editor of the Jerusalem Report and author of the forthcoming book Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terror. And we'll hear from Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh, author of the new memoir When the Birds Stopped Singing, Life in Ramallah Under Siege. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.